Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. New York City has said no to trans fats. Trans fats are these particular type of fat typically generated by heating oils to 700 and some odd degrees and bubbling hydrogen through them, partially hydrogenated fats, because the Harvard School of Public Health said that by our most conservative estimate, replacement of partially hydrogenated fat in the U.S. diet with naturally unhydrogenated vegetable oils would prevent approximately 30,000 premature coronary deaths per year. And epidemiological evidence suggests this number is closer to 100,000 premature deaths annually. In other words, to keep people from dying. Andrew Bernstein is with the Ayn Rand Institute, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D. Andrew specializes in objectivism, capitalism, and business ethics with Ayn Rand, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D.org, AynRand.org, the website, AndrewBernstein.net, his website. He also teaches at Marist College. Andrew, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good to be back, Tom.
Good to have you on, Andrew, and one of the reasons why I think it's so useful for our listeners to hear from you folks at Ayn Rand is because you guys are the thinkers, or at least Ayn Rand, and you're carrying that torch, are the thinkers behind the libertarians and the conservatives of today, although I know that you would disavow both of them in this whole idea that, for all practical purposes, government should do absolutely nothing at all except for protect the borders and run the police department. You're saying that the New York's overstepped.
Oh, without a doubt. I have no question that, you know, trans fats are dangerous to people's health, just like cholesterol, saturated fats, etc. And I think we should avoid that stuff. But the issue is a moral one here, and that is, you know, it's the right of any adult human being to choose whatever he wants to eat, and it's the right of a restaurateur to offer on his menu whatever it chooses. I mean, the government of a free country has no moral right to dictate to the citizens of that country what foods they can or cannot include in their diet.
Are you suggesting that it is not the right of people in a community to get together and say, we do not want the vendors in this community to poison us?
Yeah, I definitely think it's not their right.
Why not?
What they can do is they can economically boycott, you know, the products. They can not buy them themselves. They can use rational persuasion to convince
them. But what if the vendor doesn't tell them?
What's that?
What if the vendor doesn't tell them? I mean, I've never walked in. I've eaten in a lot of restaurants in New York City over the last, you know, 30 years or so, and I have never once seen a menu that says, here's how much trans fats in this particular meal.
No, I understand that, but I think in a free country, there's no way to prevent the information from being disseminated. So when the Harvard, you know, study comes out, the newspapers report it, et cetera, I've been reading the newspapers for several years now. And this is the New York Post, the conservative paper in town, never mind, you know, the New York Times. I've been reading it for several years, the danger of trans fats, and we've known for 40 years, going back to the 60s, the danger of saturated fats and cholesterol. And I think a rational person makes their choice to lay off that stuff or to eat it in moderation. And you could use rational persuasion to convince others, but it's not the right of the government to impose on people what they can or cannot eat. And we've learned the futility of this. Bombing and prohibition showed us this. The war on drugs shows us that it's impossible for paternalistic governments to protect individuals from their own irrationalities.
Actually, I'd say the exact opposite is the case. I mean, Upton Sinclair back in 1906 when he wrote The Jungle, it was about, you know, rat-infested slaughterhouses, rancid meat, how the meatpacking industry was packing what they call 4D animals, dead, dying, diseased, and disabled. People were literally dying all across the United States. Millions of people were dying across the United States from contaminated food. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, got so incensed from reading The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's novel, and from seeing this, that he created the Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, and we've saved millions of lives in America. You don't think that there should be a Meat Inspection Act or Pure Food and Drug Act?
No. And I don't think that the, I don't think the FDA saves lives. I think it takes lives. I think it kills people by, you know, for instance, by, you know, not permitting the pharmaceutical companies for years to advertise that aspirin in small doses can, you know, can prevent heart attacks. I think what saves lives is the advances in technology. I think that's what would save lives. People are dying from, you know, impure food forever. They still do in the non-capitalist third world countries. But the advances in technology enable us to process food or to you know, produce food, and refrigerate food in ways that keep it clean, you know, free of germs, et cetera, et cetera. That's I think
so we should just trust the big companies.
I don't think Upton Sinclair had any positive impact. The history shows we were already moving towards cleaner food by advances in technology at the turn of the 20th century. The leftist politicians get in on at the end of the wave after this stuff already becomes known to medical research and scientific research, and we're already moving forward with technological advance.
How is it? I mean, just at the philosophical level, we're talking with Andrew Bernstein. He teaches at Marist College. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the website. How is it at the level of philosophy, Andrew, that a community getting together and saying, okay, the majority of us have decided that we want anybody who sells meat into our food supply to be inspected by us, by a representative of us, to make sure that it's not poisonous, or that if they're going to sell, that if a company in our amongst us, if one of us is going to open a restaurant, that person, that restaurant, cannot sell to us foods that we know, not even foods. Trans fats are not even foods. They're chemicals. They're compounds that are made, you know, by hydrogenating fat, by heating up fat and chemically altering it so it'll have a longer shelf life. And not only does it cause heart disease, it also apparently causes cancer and other problems. What is philosophically wrong with a community getting together and saying, we want to protect ourselves?
Well, I think it depends on how the community does it. I understand the community made up of individuals all want to protect themselves. But the way you're suggesting, I think, is a violation of the rights of both the restaurateur to offer this stuff on the menu and the right of individuals to choose to eat it.
But the restaurateur exists in the context of the community as a whole. His right to run a business is provided by the community. I mean, the community is saying, yes, we'll authorize you to run a business. We'll give you a license to have a business.
Tom, I strongly disagree with that premise. I don't think your rights or mine depends upon the privilege of the community. I think our rights are inalienable. They're built in.
So you think individual rights should always trump community rights?
Yeah, I don't think a community is only a collection of individuals. I think community rights is simply the rights of all the individual members of that community. But I don't think the individual members of the community are helpless. As you know, this knowledge gets disseminated by medical research. That's how we find out that trans fats are dangerous.
But the problem with that argument, Andrew, is that
we should boycott it, and we can use rational persuasion to convince others to boycott it, and then the rest of it to us to make money. The guys who start offering healthier food are the ones who get our business, and they're the ones who prosper.
But in fact, history, number one, doesn't demonstrate that that's the case. People are still, you know, I mean, look at Fast Food Nation, number one. Number two, your solution is an after-the-fact solution. You're saying that we should solve these problems after people have already died. We find, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are dying.
It's always after the fact. The knowledge doesn't get disseminated until there's research. You have to have the research has to be done, and you realize trans fats are dangerous. Nobody found
that. But from the time that the Harvard Review was published until the time that the average person on the street knows that there may be trans fats in the foods that they're eating in the restaurant because that restaurateur wanted to make an extra 5 cents on the hamburger that they're selling or the french fries that they're selling, that could be literally a generation for the average person to figure that out. I mean, that's how long it took for cigarettes, for example.
That's the way it's going to be anyway. I mean, the community.
But think of all the people who are going to die during that time.
Your community's not going to find out until that information is disseminated.
Why do you want to take away from the community the right to protect itself against predators?
Well, you're not listening to what I have to say. There's no greater time lag in individuals boycotting the restaurants based on this information than there is in the community passing a law based on this information, because the information has to be disseminated. And that's when people are at risk from saturated fats, trans fats, cigarettes.
But that's just not the case. I mean, back before 1906, there were companies that were selling patent medicines that contained lead and mercury as their active ingredients. We had to make those illegal to stop those corporations from doing that.
No, you don't. What you have to do is
read the history, Andrew. You know this.
You have to disseminate the information. What I'm saying to you is that in a free country that protects everybody's rights, when the information is disseminated, these guys aren't going to make any money. It's the restaurateurs who sell healthier food.
I absolutely agree with you. In a small community of a couple hundred people, we're going to figure out who the predators are. But what about a city like New York City, where you always have the ability to be anonymous and to prey on people?
No, because the people who don't realize that trans fats are dangerous, the restaurateurs can now advertise no trans fats in my food. Is going to attract all the rational people who want to live longer lives.
And the irrational people, screw them. We should just let them die. And the irrational people, screw them. We should just let them die.
Well, the point is, people are free to make their choices. The government can't protect us from our irrationality. The war on drugs is protecting any irrational person who wants to kill themselves from drugs. Is it keeping them from getting drugs?
That's a whole different topic on which actually you and I agree. Andrew Bernstein. We got to wrap it up. AndrewBernstein.net teaches at Marist College. AynRand.org, the website. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
It's always good being here, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt. White sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth.
Yes. Welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. At least we fiendishly plot for clean elections and, you know, a decent society. We would go for that. Our quote for the day from Eleanor Roosevelt: when will our consciences grow so tender that we will act to prevent human misery rather than avenge it? We'll get to this a little later on in the program. George W. Bush looks like he's going to be doubling down in Iraq. You know, I find that great fun at the blackjack table, but I wouldn't do it with lives at stake. We'll get to that. But what we were just talking about, trans fats. New York City has said no to trans fats. And it has the libertarians and the corporations all upset, and the objectivists all upset. How dare a community decide to protect itself? And I believe that's the essence of democracy, is that a community can get together and say, you know, we're going to decide what kind of life we want to have. This is what, you know, for example, why Ben Franklin, when he invented the first fire department in Philadelphia, made it compulsory. Everybody had to have a fire bucket in their house. Steve, driving in 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, first of all. Steve, driving in Nebraska. Hey, Steve, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. How you doing today? What's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, I just wanted to call and say that this gentleman, the reason he is so wrong, I deal in the meat industry. I pick up carcasses and take them from those plants to the processing plants. And I want to tell you, those plants are spotless because of one reason, because there's a federal inspector there every day.
Yeah.
Numerous times loading my truck, I'll see him in there with the plant manager, and he'll be pointing things out for them to do, to clean, to fix, whatever. They're constantly spraying down the floor with hot steaming water. My trailer has to be washed out every day with steaming hot water. And the reason being is because of the government. And this is where the government is good, and they help us out. Because if there wasn't that inspector there, and I've been to the plants where you could tell the inspector doesn't show up all the time, they're not as clean. And the one, and that's why, you know, we need these kind of inspectors, like you're saying, the community to protect ourselves.
Yeah, and it's because essentially what we've done, and the Supreme Court has actually ratified this, is we've created sociopathic entities. A corporation is required by law to have as its first priority not the delivery of clean food or the delivery of medical services or whatever it happens to be doing, but making a profit. That has to be its first priority. And making a profit is very often in conflict with delivering safe products.
So. Yeah, no, I fully agree with you, and, you know, like I was saying, because They don't want to spend the money. All the stuff they do to clean those plants, I'm sure that costs them a small little fortune. And you know they don't want to pay for that, but they have to because there's someone there to make sure. Thank you, Tom, and you have a good day.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. From Steve to Steve, this is Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Steve, what's up? Steve in Brattleboro. Whoop, Steve just vanished from our line. Okay, let's try. Interesting. I don't know if our phones are going nuts here or not here. Let's see. Scott in San Francisco, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, I'm calling about this article in The Latest Nation by Christopher Hayes.
I'm not familiar with it.
He writes for Common Dreams. I wasn't sure if you were aware of it. It's called The Roots of Paranoia. It's supposed to be this new politics. You know, if you can't trust the government, then it brings everything into question. And he's saying that that's one of the reasons why all this 9/11 skepticism is coming up.
Yeah, but, and you know, what's interesting is this really all, a lot of this goes back to this whole, you know, the whole history of Reaganism. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan coming along saying that in his opinion, right?
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah. And, you know, Reagan basically campaigned against government. He was an anti-government guy. And we've created, even though he was the ultimate insider, he was president of the United States for two terms, and we've created this bizarre mindset that somehow the government, which is supposed to be us in a democratic republic, is the bad guy. Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont, you're back on the line. You want to try it again?
Hey, sorry about that. Listen, I need to correct you on something that I've heard you kind of allude to a couple of times, and I hope you'll give me a second to do it.
We have about 30 seconds, but if it's a good one, we can hold you over. Go ahead.
Okay. A lot of times I hear you say that the definition of fascism is essentially a fusion of corporations and the government, which is really just a characteristic of it. The true idea of fascism is that the rights of the individual are superseded by the rights of the state. And when you're arguing that a community has rights over the individual, you're actually arguing for fascism, and this is on a very base level.
I disagree. That's what I'm defining is democracy, and what you're pulling out is one dimension of fascism, which is actually common to most governments. I mean, that's the whole point of people collectively getting together and forming government, is saying we are going to surrender a certain amount of our personal liberty in exchange for a collective protection. Let me put you on hold, and we'll continue this conversation on the other side of the break. Stephen, Vermont, hang on. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Well, it seems like the whole damn world's gone wrong. St. Joe McCarthy is dead and gone. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Don't try to change my mind with facts. To hell with the graduated income tax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily news, daily blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
Indeed, welcome back. You know, John Gray wrote about it. He called it a day in the life of Joe Middle Class Republican. And, Steve, I'm going to get back to your call in just a second. First, I just want to share this. Joe gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning, prepares his morning coffee, fills his pot full of good, clean drinking water because some liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. Takes his daily medication with his first swallow of coffee. His medications are safe to take because some liberal fought to ensure their safety and work as advertised. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance. Now Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs for the day. It's safe to eat because some liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. He takes his morning shower, reaching for his shampoo. His bottle's properly labeled with every ingredient and the amount of its contents because some liberal fought for his right to know what he's putting on his body. He dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is relatively clean because some tree-hugging liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. It saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees. You see, some liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the opportunity to be a contributor to society. Joe begins his work day. He's got a good job, excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, vacations, because some liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. Joe's employer pays these standards because he doesn't, you know, this is where it's at, right? It's noontime. Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. Joe's deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system in 1929. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below market federal student loan because some stupid liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and could earn more money and pay more taxes over his lifetime. Joe is home from work. Plans to visit his father this evening at the farm home in the country. Gets in his car for his drive out to Dad's house. The car is among the safest in the world because some liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home, third generation, to live in a house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't even have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose in where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Those rural Republicans would still be sitting in the dark. He's happy to see his dad, who's now retired. His dad lives on Social Security and his union pension because some liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to do it for him. After his visit with Dad, he gets back in his car for the ride home, turns on a radio talk show. The host keeps saying, liberals are bad, conservatives are good. Doesn't tell Joe that his beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout the day. Joe agrees. He says, we don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. Now, Steve, the argument that I was making is that I agree to stop at a red light in exchange for the right to drive on the public streets.
All right. Okay.
That's a trade-off between liberty and safety. And,
okay.
You know, I understand Ben Franklin's quote that those who would give up a little liberty for a little security deserve neither. But we're talking about that.
No, no, we're not. Listen, just give me 1 minute and to lay out my arguments and, you know, consider them and then I'll stop and let you move on. Here's the thing. First of all, I'll forego the Franklin quote, but your characterization of the group giving up rights for security is not the way our government is laid out. What you're actually talking about is the government's responsibility is laid out in the Constitution to provide the general welfare. That's one argument. Second argument is, in the mid-90s, as the whole Newt Gingrich style of politics was rising, the obvious relationship to fascism was so obvious that they needed to come up with a way around that. And what they came up with is the phrase communitarianism, the basic tenet of which is that the community has rights over the individual. And this is essentially fascism. What you're arguing is not that the community has a right to protect itself. What you're arguing is the government established by the individuals has an obligation to protect the citizenship. You can't go and say that the community has a right over the individual because the community doesn't exist as an entity. All you have is individuals and the government. That's the basis of my argument. Thanks for listening.
Okay. Now let me just, I think I can burst this bubble. The community in, first of all, what you were saying is that, and please turn down your radio. First of all, what you were saying was that that in fascism or in, you know, that I'm advocating fascism because I'm saying that the state should have power over individuals. And in a democracy, the state is us. So if we collectively, the state, if we agree, oh, I see Steve dropped off the phone line. Here's my argument, Steve. If we collectively say that we collectively in a democratic institution through democratically elected representatives, that we want to have, for example, clean meat, then that's not fascism. That is not surrendering our liberties. That is protecting ourselves. That's a fundamentally different thing from a fascistic state, which is no longer representing the will of the majority of the people. And that's the fundamental thing. I mean, you know, and you could argue, if you want to use that as your definition of fascism, that the Soviet Union was a fascistic state, which I would say it wasn't. It was a communist dictatorship. And I was, you know, I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. I was in East Berlin when it was East Berlin. And I've been in a number of fascistic states and communist states and dictator-run states in the over the years of my life doing international relief work for over 20 years. And I can tell you, you know, they all vary in style, but in substance, the bottom line is the people don't have the say. If the people have the say, then it's not fascism, in my opinion, Steve. I just respectfully disagree. Jay in New York. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
My comment basically is, you had said that, you know, a company's first target is to make a profit.
That's the legal requirement as defined by the Supreme Court. In fact, if you're an officer of a corporation and you fail to put profit above all other considerations, you can be prosecuted for failure to fulfill your fiduciary responsibility.
Absolutely. And again, the guy that called up who was driving, talking about meatpacking industries and, the federal government being there. You know, as an owner of that company, which again, I'm an owner of my own company, nothing to do with meat, but my first priority, besides the profit, is my liability to my employees, to my public, to my customers. And again, I just wanted to make sort of state that liability is my number one concern. I mean, even almost above profit, because you're not in business unless you're going to make a profit.
I'm assuming then, Jay, that you're dealing with a relatively local clientele. That is to say that your customers know who you are.
Correct.
Okay. The problem is, what happens when your customers don't know who you are? What happens when somebody walks into a restaurant and buys some food that was manufactured or that was packed or, whatever the proper word is, 1,000 miles away by somebody who's anonymous?
Right.
Shouldn't we collectively say, hey, wait a minute, there needs to be, because there isn't that relationship between the vendor and the customer like you have with your customers, like I have with mine. I mean, you're my customer. I own a small business called this radio show. There's not that relationship with the customer. And so instead, it's appropriate for us as a society to step in and say, we're going to protect ourselves from anonymous predators.
Absolutely, Tom. And I was just saying that, as an owner, I don't mind having that federal agent in my establishment to make sure that my product is clean because, again, it's covering my liability. I mean, that's
cool.
The point I'm
okay.
making.
I get it. Great. Jay, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Joy in Lone Pine, California. Hey, from one coast to the other. Hey, Joy, what's up?
Well, I want to say, Tom, you're my hero. I feel that I'm a new listener, and I feel that you express the facts and you have the focus and the ability to convey these things that are so very important. I'm very concerned about the trans fats. I'm a senior, and senior lunches are very popular here. You know, we have professional people eating the senior lunches that the government provides, okay? And it is very important for seniors, and they're still using trans fats. And there's actually one of the cooks that tries to put aside some of the vegetables so that they're not saturated in the margarine, the trans fats for me,
Oh, that's nice.
And this is such an important issue. People deserve to know, And until we legislate, the average person will not know how harmful this is.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, my dad was working in a field in a haze of asbestos in 1950 in a steel mill, and they had known for 30 years, 20 years, more than 20 years that would kill him, and it did, of mesothelioma. But he didn't know. I mean, it took the public another 30 years to find out. My parents were smoking cigarettes in the 50s and 60s. Ronald Reagan was on TV. I remember Ronald Reagan as a kid watching him on TV wearing a lab coat saying that he was a doctor, on TV, in an ad saying you should smoke Chesterfields if you have a cold because they're better for you. It takes a while for people to figure out, and in the meantime, we collectively need to step into the middle and say we're going to protect ourselves from these predators. Thank you, Joy, for your call. John in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, John, just have a few seconds before we've got to take a break. Is it a quick one?
If 1% of the people start questioning their restaurants about use of trans fats, you would see a change very quick, and then we would not need the middleman of government to intervene.
I agree. And I agree. And ultimately, usually the market does sort things out. The problem is that time in between. That's, the free market solution is one that deals with post-facto harm, and we want to prevent that harm before it happens.
I don't think the time span would be all that long, Tom.
Yeah, well, it certainly was with asbestos and with nicotine. So,
not in this case.
Okay, all righty. Well, I hope you're right, John. John, thanks a lot for the call. I'm still agreeing with New York on their ban. I think it's a good thing. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, Viagra for your brain.
It sure is nice, it's tough, and dead inside. I keep you on my mind both day and night. And the happiness I know proves that it's right.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Absolutely not. No way. I don't care what the Supreme Court's... Actually, they didn't say it in 1886 in the Santa Clara case. John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the court, wrote it into the headnote, and he lied about what Mr. Waite said. In fact, Mr. Waite, just before he died, in his own hand, wrote a letter to the clerk of the court saying, that ain't what I said. You can find a copy of it over at our website, TomHartmann.com. We found it in the Library of Congress. Honestly, I don't think anybody had looked at it in 100 years. Anyhow, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I'd like to give you an opinion, if I may. Hopefully, it dovetails what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe our democracy is on the ropes. And in my own words...
It's certainly under challenge.
Okay, fine. Fine, that's a better term. That's the positive term, but it may be both. Now, in my own words, I believe this. I believe we liberal progressive Democrats are the party who has before and now defined the greater good on the majority of issues affecting the future of a well-functioning democracy. And we're not functioning well.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Gary. And the Republicans have fought it every step of the way. They fought Social Security.
The
neocons, they fought unions.
Then I blame the neocons. I flatly say it.
Yeah.
And also, I just wish we'd learn a little, the good people, the good Americans that we know are out there. I wish we'd just be a little bit more humble.
Yeah, well, step by step. Gary, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's always good to hear from you. Terry in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Tom. Hey, your guest was saying that people could just advertise, you know, for selling their trans fat-free food at their restaurant.
Right.
How would we know if they're telling the truth about whether they're selling trans fat-free food? They could just lie about it. There's no regulation on them. And people wouldn't know until years later that they'd been said the wrong thing, even if they tried to make the right choices.
Yeah, you cut right to the heart of it, Terry. You really did.
With these
yeah.
guys, there's no making sure the free market. Same with the... See, he was talking about them making progress with the rats and all that anyway, but we already see with the E. coli coming out around here that these corporations, if they can cut corners, they're going to do it. And if nobody's
yeah.
there to check on them, they're going to sell it, and we can't go back and find out as individuals what they're doing wrong.
Right, and again, what I would guess that you know a libertarian would say is, well, if somebody was lying about having trans fats when they saying they did it, they don't have it when they, in fact they do have it, eventually people would figure it out because everybody going to their restaurant would have heart attacks. Well, maybe 20 years later, maybe 15 years later, maybe a generation later. Again, these free market solutions solve problems after the fact.
But they also want to take away their right to sue when they do find out years later.
Yeah, absolutely. There's the ultimate irony. Terry, thank you for the call and for, you know, well said. Jeff in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. How are you this morning? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, the whole difficulty with Ayn Rand is that she preaches this idea of personal responsibility to the exclusion of the group. Because the truth is like the guy said, he thinks we're a collection of individuals. We're not. When you're in a group, you get to provide for things like specialization. For example, how was I ever going to know that mercury was going to kill me, right?
Right.
So somebody figures that out. They specialize. They say, hey, guys, we've got a problem over here. We need to do something about it. Second issue is there is no level playing field. This country has made corporations into super beings.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they reduce the rights of the individual to participate in the society. And so at some point, in terms of defending yourself, the group has to get together and say, you know, this is how we defend ourselves from these kinds of people.
And we always have. Going all the way back to Aboriginal and Indigenous societies who are still living the way that humans were living 50 and 100,000 years ago, we have always collectively banded together to protect ourselves, whether it's family, tribe, community, clan, or nation. We have always done that. And, Ayn Rand, where I think Ayn Rand went wrong, you know, she grew up in Bolshevik Russia. Her father's pharmacy was taken from him during the Bolshevik Revolution. And she went to college in the Soviet system under Stalin Kiev, I think, that she went to college, and studied political science. And then she came to the United States. And she thought that there were two kinds of political systems. capitalism and communism. She never realized that capitalism is not an a political system. It's an economic system.
Right.
And democracy is a political system. And the communists, you know, blurred all that. And this fundamental misunderstanding of hers has now filtered into libertarian thought, into so-called conservative thought in America. You got, you know, people like John Stossel out there running around, you know, promulgating this. I mean, it's absolutely tragic. Jeff, well said, and thank you very much. David in Olympia, Washington. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi there. See, I wanted to get your thoughts. I just started reading this fascinating book on James Madison, and maybe some of this goes back to his writings, particularly the Federalist Papers. I'm curious what you think about his idea, that his fear of communities legislating in their own cause.
I'd have to know the specific writing. Madison, just like Jefferson, very often you read some of his stuff from pre-1787, post-1787, pre his presidency and post his presidency, and they contradict themselves. I mean, you know, he moved and evolved. It was Madison who, in Federalist 10, 1787, said that that we don't want a democracy in the United States, we want a republic. And,
yes.
You know, and redefine these terms, whereas 1 year earlier in the dictionary, you look up democracy and it would say see republic. You look up republic, it would say see democracy. And then it was Madison himself who in 1822, as I recall, after he left the presidency as an old man, said, you know, I just said that because I was trying to make an argument to sell the Constitution. A democracy and a republic are the same thing, and that's what we have here in the United States. So, you know, I'd have to know these specific contexts. David, thanks for the call, though. We got to wrap up this hour. Coming up at the next hour, Jeffrey Feldman is going to be with us. The editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is open. And just amazing, this doubling down strategy that George W. Bush is going to be pursuing. I'm going to tell you about that. The Saudis have said jump. Bush has said how high. Oh, there's so much to talk about, so much coming up. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Exposing the con in conservatives. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, live from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific time, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern time. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeffrey Feldman. In the studio in New York with us, he is the editor-in-chief over frameshopisopen.com. And be sure you get the is open in there, because frameshop.com is a porn site. So, hey, Jeffrey, welcome.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. One of our nation's leading experts on framing. You have a new book coming out.
New book, yes, Framing the Debate, Famous Presidential Speeches and How Progressives Can Use Them to Shape the Conversation and Win Elections. Well, it's on Amazon.com. Everyone can pre-order it today. Fun to read, inexpensive.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it myself. Congratulations. I think it's absolutely marvelous. On Frame Shop is Open, your website, frameshopisopen.com, your top story, the GOP smear gangs target Obama. And actually, you go down a little farther down, you talk about how the GOP is using Obama's frame in a more competent way than he is. Take these step by step here.
Exactly. Barack Obama has rocketed to the top of people's attention in going to New Hampshire and talking about declaring a candidacy for president, which it seems like he's going to do. And starting today, I just noticed, getting a few emails from readers, that the GOP is actually calling him Barack Hussein Obama, Hussein being his middle name, in an attempt to spread a whisper smear campaign accusing him of being a covert terrorist. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable that they're doing
this. Or perhaps even more subtly, a covert Muslim.
A covert Muslim, exactly. And I found this post, this remarkable post on a right-wing website, a website called Either People. Everyone can check it out. It's on Frameshop, in which this author, it lays out a case that I've heard over and over again, that Obama converted to Christianity as a child using an obscure law in Islam, which allows people supposedly to convert to Christianity with the sole purpose of infiltrating the infidels in order at a certain point in time to do harm to the American people and the American government.
And this is completely made up.
It's completely made up. And the long-term goal, obviously, is to use Obama's middle name in order to confuse the American public into thinking that he's some type of terrorist enemy. And it's just absolutely shameless. And what I write about in the piece is that what's going on here is actually much larger than one political candidate on the Democratic Party. But it's a broad problem that the Republican Party has, these gangs that mobilize on behalf of their party in order to take down anybody who challenges them, riding in and intimidating people, using fear to convince people not to participate in the political system.
Right, and then they pay for it on the back end. This story just up over at muckraker.com, TPM Muckraker, FEC fines Swift Boat vets $300,000. You know, the Federal Election Commission hit the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth with a $299,500 fine today for playing too loose with the election rules. Yeah, great. So they pay $300,000, but they flip an election.
Yeah, and they can afford that money.
It's chump change for these guys.
Absolutely chump change. And what people need to do is just speak out very loudly. And right now, we can't let these types of campaigns get any traction whatsoever. People need to shine a light on them in any way that they can. If you have access to a blog, you want to write letters into your local newspaper, call these groups by their names. These are political operatives who are attempting to control our political system. They're not telling the truth. They're not doing anything good at all.
Well, you're framing them as smear gangs. Maybe that's a new frame. I mean, you know, it's a new phrase. Perhaps there's an older one that we could use. I mean, one doesn't immediately come to mind, but other than liar, I mean, you know, it's good old fashioned. But how did Barack Obama end up with the middle name Hussein? Is it just a family name?
I think it's just something that his father gave him. I believe it's mentioned in his first book, so I have to go back there and check it out.
Yeah, because that's the question that's going to have to be answered, unfortunately.
And he has to answer it very quickly, which brings me to the next issue, which is how Obama himself is using this notion of common sense, a phrase that's being repeated by him and also by John McCain, the leading Republican candidate, who's been calling himself a common sense conservative. In which Obama is basically saying that common sense means no negative campaigning. And so Obama's really painting himself into a corner here where he's going to be attacked because he's at the top of the media right now. But he's basically saying, I'm not going to do negative campaigning, painting himself into a corner in a way that's remarkably similar to what John Kerry did.
Yeah. And, well, let's hope the outcome isn't the same. I personally have not yet made up my mind on Barack Obama. He seems like a decent guy. I'm, you know, far more fond of John Edwards at the moment, but who knows? I mean, I think frankly any of these guys are decent. I mean, even Hillary Clinton, if enough progressives start speaking out and pushing them in a populist and progressive direction, I think that most politicians will go the way that the populace goes. I mean, you know, George W. Bush being the crazed exception. You talk over at Frameshop. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief at FrameshopIsOpen.com. You talk over at FrameshopIsOpen.com about national oilism.
It's a hard word to get out. I spent last week reading this Iraq Study Group report in an attempt to try to understand exactly what these folks were saying. In other words, to distinguish between what the media was saying and what was actually written in black and white on the pages. And I found a couple of things. The first is the centrality of oil in the Baker Commission recommendations for bringing back Iraq. The entire plan for reviving Iraq, both in terms of the civil war that's going on over there, the multiple civil wars, and the lagging economy, is based on centralizing the oil production in Iraq. According to this report, there are clauses in the American written Iraqi constitution which essentially divides oil up amongst different factions, different regions in Iraq, and this itself is causing tension. And so the Baker Commission suggests that if only oil could be centralized, then a lot of the problems could be solved in Iraq.
Well, it would be certainly one way of creating a strong central government. I mean, it worked for Saddam Hussein.
Exactly.
He was able to distribute oil money to the Sunnis who don't have oil, and you know they were quite grateful to him for that.
It also would create this a new crop of oil billionaires who could relate directly to American oil tycoons and turn it into another, you know, version of other Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, and that's the other story, is that the American oil companies are already there and they want to be there in a bigger and more lasting way.
Exactly.
In fact, the Iraq Study Group on the one hand, is calling for more privatization of the oil industry in Iraq. The oil industry is the only industry that the Constitution allowed to still remain semi-nationalized, and they're saying, let's take it even farther. You also point out in the Iraq Study Group that I thought this was really interesting. I had not caught this, and I haven't heard this, frankly, from anybody else, that the Iraq Study Group, you say this one sentence, quote, "There is no action the American military can take that by itself can bring about success in Iraq." That sentence has been interpreted by the press, by and large, as saying basically there has to be a political solution here rather than a military solution. And you're saying that it actually has a very different meaning when you read it in context.
Yeah, the big discussion that's unfolded in the media has been that the Baker Commission is essentially saying that we need to pull troops back, not saying, pull them out, but pull them back. But if you actually read the text, it's a two-step process in the ISG report. They're saying, first, the American military needs to embed troops deeper into the Iraqi military. And only after that point could come the idea that we could withdraw our troops. So what they're really proposing is deeper engagement in Iraq with the possibility of withdrawal. And this is doubled up with a deeper engagement also by the American criminal system, the idea of having FBI forensic teams go and train Iraqis ostensibly to help control terrorists and over there and track down people creating, blowing up buses and markets and so forth.
Yeah, now this is essentially what, if press reports are to be believed, particularly the ones coming out in the last 24 hours, this is essentially what George W. Bush is going to be pushing for. And yet the media is characterizing Bush's, double down strategy, his he's going with the John McCain strategy. They're characterizing that as a violation of the Iraq Study Group. Why the disconnect?
Well, your guess is as good as mine, but I believe that part of what the Iraq Study Group is doing is providing the president cover to look a little bit tough, so he can say that he's not letting anyone tell him what to do, at the same time follow as many of the recommendations as he can. What Bush wants to do is talk about success, talk about staying the course, and that's exactly what he's going to say when he speaks to the country in January.
These are the frames that he's using.
Exactly.
And thus he's meeting with the pro increasing the troop level generals and like that.
I think he's just waiting it out so that he can say something beyond, let the Fuhrer calm down, and he can reclaim the momentum in the debate and again look like he is leading.
Very interesting. Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief, frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. We'll be right back.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. Now there was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows. The bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the love, this is God. The way the camera just follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to the song.
And welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. called it when he was booed when he came to visit Portland, Oregon. Welcome back to our program. Time for our...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment brought to you by theliberalstore.com, selling liberal and progressive T-shirts, bumper stickers, buttons, and more. Their bumper sticker of the week: no, you can't have my rights, I'm still using them. Their phone number, 1-800-386-5846, theliberalstore.com. Here's the story. Believe it or not, this is in the San Francisco Chronicle. Liberal and progressive Christian groups say a new computer game in which players must either convert or kill non-Christians is the wrong gift to give this holiday season, and that Walmart, a major video game retailer, should yank it off its shelves. The Campaign to Defend the Constitution, a progressive group, and the, excuse me, a conservative group, and the Christian Alliance for Progress, a progressive group. Actually, I'm not sure which one's left and which one's right. Well, one's one and the other's the other. Two online political groups plan to demand today that Walmart dump Left Behind Eternal Forces, a PC game inspired by the series of Christian novels, hugely popular, especially with teens. Over 60 million of these books have been sold. Series of, by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, based on their particular interpretation of the Bible's book of Revelation that takes place after the rapture when Jesus has taken his people to heaven and left non-believers to face the Antichrist, who by coincidence just happens to be the head of the United Nations. In the according to Left Behind Games president Jeffrey Fritschner, the game, he says, is actually pacifist because players lose spirit points every time they gun down non-believers rather than convert them. They can only earn spirit points by having their character pray instead of being killed. And Todd, Marina, California, outside of Walmart, picketing this very topic, eh?
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Todd, what's happening?
Oh, I just got out here, and I've got my picket sign. And
which says what?
It says Walmart sells hate crime video games.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And when I read this yesterday, I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Now, are you with one of these two groups that's picketing,
no,
or you're just all by yourself there?
I mean, I'm just a private citizen that's outraged.
Yeah. Are there other people out there with you?
No, I just got here.
Interesting.
I talked on the one of the local programs on the radio before your show, and hopefully some people heard it and they might come out.
Yeah.
But I believe in the power of one.
There you go. Well said, Todd. So which Walmart are you at?
I'm at the Walmart in Marina, California.
In Marina, California.
Which it just opened up within the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And demographically, the city of Marina is the seventh most diverse city of its size in the United States.
Well, that's it.
And I went to the city council meeting last night and shared my feelings, and I looked at the mayor and the council members, and I said, you know, I don't think this represents our citizens or our values.
Mm-hmm.
And the looks I got back were more of discomfort and why are you here saying this?
Yeah.
You know, there was a big brouhaha on Walmart coming in the first place, you know, because of their labor practices and such.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I talked to Walmart corporate yesterday, and they have no intentions of pulling the game.
Yeah.
But I think that our NBC affiliate and CBS are on their way out here right now.
Yeah.
So okay. I think
it's
that
the power of one. It's the power of one. Good on you, Todd. Good on you. And you know, it's not. By the way, let's make it clear. As much as we'd like to, you know, kind of play the song. Yeah, you know, it's easy to pick on them, but the fact of the matter is that what Walmart is doing is perfectly legal, and what you're doing should be perfectly legal, and it's a matter of saying, because they're not the only, by the way, retailer. Apparently, according to the manufacturer, Sam's Club, Target, Best Buy, Circuit City, GameStop,
yeah.
EB Games, Christian
right.
stores all across the country are carrying this. The enemy team includes fictional rock stars and folks with Muslim-sounding names, while the righteous include gospel singers, missionaries, healers, and medics.
Well, the worst part of the article that I read was it said, this is good family fun. Mom, Dad, and Junior can come together, play the game, and talk about the Bible.
And kill the unbelievers.
Oh,
it's like
just,
the Crusades are here all over again.
Well, yeah, and the game retails for $39.95. And I'm not a betting man, but once this gets a little more exposure, I don't think that Walmart's going to believe that $39 is worth the cost of admission.
Yeah. Well said. Well, good luck, Todd. Thanks a lot for the call and for letting us know. And good luck on your picketing out there. And I suspect that there will be more coming up. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change.
Here they come again, can't you sit again, time to get a move on, we are with all of our might, can't you sit
back. Tom Hartman here with you. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Washington Post reporting that Saudi Ambassador Prince Turki Al-Faisal has suddenly and unexpectedly quit his post. This is from the Crimes and Corruption of the New World Order News, but also the Washington Post. This report may be concerning. See, the last time Prince Turki Al-Faisal suddenly quit his post was when he was head of Saudi External Intelligence for 24 years, and on September 4th of 2001, decided, okay, I'm packing it in. So, you know, what's that, 5 days before 9/11? He quit. And yesterday, he quit. This from the Washington Post. Prince Turki Al-Faisal, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States, flew out of Washington yesterday after informing Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and his staff that he would be leaving the post after only 15 months in the job. The abrupt departure is particularly striking because his predecessor, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, spent 22 years in the job. This is, you know, one of the most important and powerful positions that a Saudi can have in the world. He told his staff he wants to spend more time with his family. Yeah. Colleagues said they're shocked at the decision. The exit, again, this is from the Washington Post, the exit without the fanfare, parties, and tributes that normally accompany a leading envoy's departure, much less a public statement, comes as his brother, Prince Saud Al-Faisal, the highly influential Saudi foreign minister, is ailing. What's going on here? This at the same time that over at Think Progress, the Center for American Progress, quoting on their blog, the New York Times. Well, I might as well just quote the New York Times. The New York Times saying Saudi Arabia has told the Bush administration that it might provide financial backing to Iraqi Sunnis in any war against Iraq's Shiites if the United States pulls its troops out of Iraq. King Abdullah has also expressed strong opposition to diplomatic talks between the United States and Iran. Now, since that was first published, the governor of Saudi Arabia has come out and said, no, that ain't true. But George W. Bush, it looks like he's going to try and do what, you know, for fun I do in, you know, occasionally in a casino, doubling down, right? You play blackjack. Every time you bet a dollar, and when you win, you've got $2. Now you put one back in your pocket, and you can just keep that original dollar. You keep playing with it. If you lose, then you double to $2. If you lose again, you double to $4. You lose again, you double to $8. You lose again, you double to $16. Then you win, and you put you've got your original dollar back. Now, the problem is the house will always get you because their top bet is, you know, you'll double down until the point where you hit, you know, you've gone beyond the maximum bet. So, you know, it doesn't always work. I mean, I've never had it not work, but I know that I play on my cell phone. Sometimes it doesn't work. Last year, I was visiting a friend in London, went to the casino, made it £200 in about an hour, did the same thing in Amsterdam a couple of years ago. $300-$400 in an hour or so. But, you know, this is small-time stuff. I'm not doubling down on the lives of other people. But apparently that's what George Bush is going to do because the Saudis have said, we don't want you leaving Iraq. Because if you leave Iraq, then we're going to have to get involved in this thing, and we just assume you did the fighting for us. We just assume you clean up your own mess, Mr. Bush. It's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing shakes out. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. John in North Hollywood, California. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hello. I heard you talk about this Iraq Study Group talk about the privatization, and all I can think is that these political hacks in there are just earmarking oil in there to make this war all about oil, and then it shows that they don't respect the Iraqi constitution, and it just gives
which we rewrote
to all those anarchists in the world not to respect constitutional authority.
Yeah, well, first of all, the Iraqi constitution that we rewrote. I mean, you know, we illegally rewrote their constitution. Now, they have since theoretically legally rewritten it, but the original one we illegally rewrote, number one. So, yeah, but good point, and point made. Number two, consider, James Baker, you know, Baker Botts, his law firm is defending the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia right now against 9/11 victim claims. He's listed in, you know, who's who of oil attorneys. Lawrence Eagleburger, who was on this commission, used to be a principal, was one of the founding principals, in Kissinger and Associates. I mean, you know, he was on the board of directors of Halliburton up until last year.
More anarchists.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely nuts.
Well, John, we need to respect other nations' constitutions. If we're going to respect our own, we need to respect others. Also.
Yeah, and there are people
flag and not burn their flags and blow up their countries.
Yeah, you know, well said, John. Thank you. And in fact, when George Bush was invading Iraq, he turned to remember the speech he gave? And he turned to the camera and he says, "No, I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq." And I'm sitting there expecting him to say, "You know, your kids are just like ours and they don't want to die. We're the biggest military machine in the world. Just lay down your arms and put your hands up and, you know, we won't kill anybody. Everything will be fine. Don't worry." But instead, Bush turns to the camera and says to the people of Iraq,
"Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells."
And all over the world, people's jaws hit the floor, and they said, "Oh, my God, now we've got it." What Dick Cheney had said a few weeks earlier.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Must have had something to do with why we were going into Iraq. Now, personally, I'm of the opinion that we didn't go in there to get the oil, but rather to stop the oil from going onto world markets so that we could drive the price of the oil up. But I don't even think that was the primary reason. I think Cindy Sheehan nailed it down when she talked about Mickey Herskowitz, the guy, old family friend of the Bush family, who was hired by the Bush family to write A Charge to Keep, which is George W. Bush's autobiography. Her testimony before the John Conyers Commission. I suppose, I don't know if commission is the right word, because Tom DeLay refused to authorize it so that he didn't have subpoena power. But they were meeting in the basement of the Capitol building, and John Conyers was calling witnesses. And Cindy Sheehan told the story, which is absolutely true and well corroborated.
"As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, 'One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all his political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency,'" end quote.
So back in 1999, Bush was planning on invading Iraq. Why? So that he could roll back the New Deal, as Limbaugh likes to say.
"Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well."
Yeah, no more unemployment insurance, no more health care, no more Social Security, no more right to unionize. All those things that Roosevelt brought us, let's just get rid of all of them. Greg in Danville, California. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I'm calling in regards to what you had just talked about before. I'm pretty flabbergasted by this whole Saudi Arabia coming out of nowhere to pretty much dictate the foreign policy now for us to decide when we're going to take our troops out. And I'm just as curious as you are to see what's going on. And I know that the Bush family's been in, you know, has been in with the Saudis for a long time, but for the Saudis to file...
Well, Bush Sr. was having breakfast with Osama bin Laden's brother on 9/11.
Right.
I mean, they watched the planes hit the towers together. Yeah, the Bush family has over $1 billion has been transferred from the Saudi royal family and families associated with them, including the bin Laden family, to the Bush family and businesses associated with them over the last 30 years. That's not an insignificant relationship.
Yeah, and, you know, just to see, now it's interesting that they come out just as the Democrats are set to take power, and just wondering what is going to be going on behind the scenes with their family and the Saudis, and maybe trying to undermine the Democrats and trying to get a policy straightened out there. And
well, the folks over at Crimes and Corruption in the New World Order, they're concerned about a false flag hit coming. What they're saying is that the last time that Prince Turki Al-Faisal turned tail and ran was right before 9/11, and they're concerned that there's going to be another attack on the United States. That last one was 14 Saudis, you'll recall, flying airplanes, or at least that's the official story. Might this be another attack inside the United States that would give Bush exactly what he needs in terms of, having power, increasing presidential power, stopping investigations, maybe even suspending Congress, God only knows. I mean, that I realize that sounds incredibly paranoid, and I frankly don't think that the Democrats would tolerate that. But, 5 years ago, you could not have convinced me that Congress would pass a law suspending habeas corpus, and they did. You could not have convinced me 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that Congress would pass a law doing away with posse comitatus, and they did. I mean, you couldn't have convinced me that Congress would pass a law saying that the police can sneak into your home and go through your things without a warrant, without going to before a judge, that they could do sneak and peeks. And Congress passed that as part of the Patriot Act, and they just nailed it down into permanent law. So, I don't think I'm paranoid, but God only, heaven only knows. We'll see. Hey, there you go. Time for our progressive pop quiz. Our question for the day. This month, New York City banned what? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM. 866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And we have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question once again this month, New York City banned what? And congratulations to Steve Runyon in Walker, Michigan. Bravo, Steve. Listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids, clear channel station there. Steve knew that the correct answer is trans fats, banned on Tuesday of last week, I guess it was, or on the 5th, whatever day that was, on the 5th. Thank you, David. Tuesday, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Stephen in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I'm a big fan of yours. I'm glad to talk to you. I want to express my concerns about Barack Obama that was mentioned. But first, if I could ask you very briefly a question. I lived in Portland as a teenager almost 20 years ago, and I just wondered, what was that first Bush talking about, that joke that I welcomed to Little Beirut? What was that mean? I didn't get that. What was he referring
to? He came here. I didn't actually live here when it happened, but my understanding is that this was back when Bush 1 was president, and he came here and was heckled, and he made a joke about Portland being Little Beirut, and that Beirut, Lebanon at the time was shall we say, a center of conflict.
Anyway, let me just, I'm really glad that you had the gentleman from frameshotisopen.com, because what he was talking about Barack Obama is what's really distressing me for weeks. You know, I'm as thrilled as everyone that we, the Democrats, took back control of this, the House and the Senate, which was really a great surprise and, really great. But we have to absolutely win the presidency in 2008. You know, I know the problems with all with the machines and everything, but let's just hope that, we can do it. But Barack Obama, as nice as a guy is, he would be a sure loser. First of all, it's not just because of his race. I mean, I would vote for anyone who's purple or green or whatever, like that way. But the fact when he says that he's not going to fight back, he's against negative campaigning. And the smear campaign, there are so many, never underestimate the amount of ignorant people in the country that when they hear his middle name, that alone will turn many people off. And, when he said, but when he really distresses me, and when he says that he doesn't believe in negative campaigning, well, people may say they're against negative campaigning, but just ask Max Cleland, just ask Kerry, just ask Michael Dukakis, just ask Tom Daschle, it works. And when he says he's not going to counterattack, I heard him say that when Tim Russert interviewed him on Meet the Press in October, and even he asked him, he said, well, what if, and he said, well, he said, I'll just have the results will have to just speak for themselves. So he's actually saying that he'd rather lose than engage in any counterattack. And the Republicans are just...
Well, I'm not inside Barack Obama's mind. I don't even know the guy. But perhaps what he was saying was... regardless of what he was saying, there is a difference between launching a negative attack on the one hand, and responding to a negative attack. And I don't think that he said that he wouldn't respond to them. I think he said he wouldn't use negative tactics to campaign. That's a world of difference. John Kerry let, you know, what, 3 weeks go by from the time the first Swift boat attacks occurred before he addressed them? He thought that the press was going to laugh at it and it was going to go away. Huge and fatal mistake. He should have, on the very day that it came out, said, I am outraged. How dare they? This is absolutely wrong. These people are liars, and called them out on it. But he, you know, he failed to. That wouldn't have been a negative attack. That would have been a statement of fact.
Yeah, well, I heard him, Barack Obama, say that he would not counterattack. He didn't just say negative. He said counterattack. He says Hezbollah, he believes that, like, that he will give a positive message and let people believe what they want. Well, that's not, I'm not a political expert or anything, but anyone knows with common sense, that's not how modern politics works, especially not with the Republicans. And
I find it hard to believe, Stephen, that what he was saying was that he would not respond to an attack.
Well, let me just,
I really do.
If I can make one final point, I know a lot of progressives and liberals are really against and down on Hillary Clinton, but I just got to say this. There's probably no Democrat in the country that has more experience and has been more of a veteran in dealing with Republican attack machine, which has been going on for 30 years against the Clintons, than Hillary Clinton. I think that despite, you know, a lot of problems that progressives have with her on decisions such as, you know, with the war and other things like that, she is a solid Democrat and she knows how to win.
Stephen, here's my I don't disagree with you. Here's my position on this. My first choice would be somebody like John Edwards or Russ Feingold or Howard Dean. I mean, I think that or Barbara Boxer. I think that there are some real solid progressives out there. But the fact of the matter is that we make a fatal mistake in America, not just the Democratic Party. We make a fatal mistake in America in thinking that it's all about the leaders. We don't elect leaders in this country. We elect representatives. I know that George W. Bush doesn't understand that. You know, his whole
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
But the fact of the matter is we don't elect dictators either. And when the majority of the people start pushing, I mean, Abraham Lincoln was elected when, you know, you go back and read the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he was not calling for an end to slavery. In fact, he said that there's a barrier between the races that will be there forever. He was, you know, when the majority of the people got to that place, he got to that place. Teddy Roosevelt was not elected as an anti-corporate, anti-monopolistic, reformer, a progressive. He was elected as a rich, white, corporatist Republican. And when he figured out the direction the majority of the people were going, Franklin Roosevelt, 1932, ran a very moderate centrist campaign that would be very similar to the way that Hillary Clinton is positioning herself right now. And yet he transformed America because he figured out what America, you know, what Americans wanted. So I'm not so concerned, frankly, with who the candidate is. I'm more concerned with whether or not the grassroots, whether people like you and I are out there pushing whoever the candidate is in the appropriate direction.
I absolutely agree with that, and that's absolutely right, and I've heard that about Franklin Roosevelt too. But let me just say this: it's important to get someone who has the political skills that knows how to fight back against the inevitable Republican character assassination. And
well said, Stephen. Well said. I'm with you on that. But time will tell who that is. I saw John Edwards yesterday on Hardball, and he said, let the process work its way. I'm paraphrasing. You've got a primary process, and you sift out the wheat from the chaff there. And he's been through it, and he's apparently going to go through it again. And I wish him the best on it. And we'll see. We'll find out. Can Hillary survive that? Can Barack Obama and whatnot? I think we have much more important work to be doing right now, just waking people up to the toxicity of the Republicans. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Boy, a lot of strange stuff in the news that I suspect is not getting a lot of coverage. First of all, last month, this from the Associated Press. Daniel Kerner's parents knew the experimental brain surgery was risky, but without it, the six-year-old surely would die. Last month in Portland, Oregon, doctors for the first time transplanted stem cells from aborted fetuses into his head in a desperate bid to reverse or at least slow a rare genetic disorder called Batten disease. The so far incurable condition normally results in blindness and paralysis before death. They're not sure yet if it's worked, but the kid's doing good enough that he could go home. He lives in Orange County, California. So, interesting. Interesting. We'll see how this thing shakes out. That's they've succeeded with mice on this. So, see how it's going to happen with people. But here's a broader issue. If jobs at General Motors, this is the Delaware Online, this is from the newspaper, the News Journal, Delaware newspaper. If jobs at General Motors or Daimler Chrysler's plant in Delaware suddenly moved to China, people wouldn't be shocked. Manufacturing jobs have been moving offshore for years. But if major corporations decided it was cheaper working with lawyers in India, it's happening. DuPont has started the trend. Lawyers in India, top-end corporate lawyers familiar with American law, $50 to $70 an hour compared with over $200 an hour in the United States. An Indian lawyer working as a temp, $20 an hour, whereas in this country, $70 an hour. They're expecting this year 79,000 lawyers' jobs are going to go to India. DuPont, the second largest private employer in the state, has a crew of about 100 lawyers, mostly in India, who are available around the clock to review documents. This is from Delaware Online, this article by the lady Tassie. Has a crew of about 100 lawyers, mostly in India, who are available around the clock to review documents in such complex matters as asbestos lawsuits. The company expects to save 30 to 60% on the traditional costs, amounting to more than $6 million a year off its legal bills. At first, only the simplest legal work was sent overseas. Today, that's changing. DuPont took a leap of faith. See, this is the same thing that General Electric did. You know, GE was the company that really started the whole move to India back 15 years ago or so with back office stuff, you know, white collar jobs. And now it's moving into the legal area. DuPont took a leap of faith last year when it hired Office Tiger, an Indian company with a U.S. base, to handle some of its most important projects, including one with millions of pages of documents and more than $100 million of claims related to asbestos litigation. DuPont has now given them several additional projects. Says Mr. Sager, a DuPont spokesman, they can handle anything of a complex nature, toxic tort, insurance coverage cases, complex commercial, intellectual property. Most of DuPont's legal work is sent to India, some to the Philippines, where lawyers there speak English and are familiar with the U.S. legal system. Office Tiger lawyers based in the U.S. review some of the work performed in India and the Philippines. The argument, you know, that Tom Friedman makes in The World is Flat and The Olive Tree and the Lexus, and that Bill Clinton made, and that George Herbert Walker Bush made, when Ross Perot was having the debates and he was saying, yeah, you hear that giant sucking sound? You know, that crazy old coot with the big ears. He was not crazy. Ross Perot was right back in 1992. He was right. And frankly, I think we should be looking at tariffs on work that travels via the internet as well as work that travels via ships. It's not impossible to enforce. It's not at all impossible to enforce. In fact, it wouldn't even be particularly difficult to enforce. Things happen all the time in the business world. Things get bought and sold all the time that don't have a physical, tangible reality. Intellectual property. A tariff where you say, okay, that's fine. You know, if you want to hire a lawyer in India for $50 an hour, when a lawyer in the United States would make $100 an hour, you can do that. But for every hour that that lawyer in India bills, you're going to have to pay a $50 tax on the importation of the intellectual effort that that lawyer is making. Or do we just want to say, yeah, we're not going to have a legal industry in the United States any longer? I mean, this is how it happens. This is how countries get hollowed out. The United States is becoming a third world country. We have lost our manufacturing base, the vast majority of it. We are now, because we no longer make anything the rest of the world wants to buy, instead of buying things from us, they are buying us. They are buying our companies. They are buying our land. They are buying our buildings. And this isn't, you know, evil, nasty companies overseas, or, you know, this isn't bashing the Chinese or whatever, although I'm not real fond of the government of communist China. I've been there. I know that if you speak out against that government, as an American, you probably don't have much of a problem, but as a Chinese citizen, you're toast. You know, a country that executes people so that they can sell their organs, I have a few problems with, but this isn't about China's domestic policies. This is about them simply taking advantage of the stupidity of American politicians dating back to Ronald Reagan and cheerleaders for these economic policies like Tom Friedman. And what's this doing? It's bankrupting the United States. It's destroying our manufacturing infrastructure, and now it's destroying our white-collar infrastructure. And what's the solution? Well, we were speaking of Barack Obama in the last hour, and this very much is not to pick on Barack Obama. I'm not trying to bash Obama. What I'm pointing out is how hard it is for any politician, even a fairly progressive politician, to talk about this topic, because it's not politically correct. Obama gave a speech in New Hampshire. Presumably, this is his first campaign speech, as you know, presidential campaign speech. And he said, and I quote, "People notice what's going on overseas, and they say we are not afraid to compete. But as globalization advances and corporation bottom lines know no borders, and our young people are competing against children, not just in California or Florida or Illinois, they are competing against folks in Calcutta and Beijing." So, hey, it sounds like he gets it. You know, for 200 years in the United States, we did what most of the other countries in the world are doing right now. We protected our domestic industries by saying, okay, there are some industries here that we're going to protect with tariffs. There are some industries we don't care about protecting. You know, does it matter in the United States if we have a carved sandalwood industry? Thailand exports a lot of carved sandalwood. They grow the trees. They carve it very elegant. You know, beautiful stuff. You go over to Thailand and buy this stuff. You can buy it here, imported. Should we have a tariff on carved sandalwood? I don't think so. It's not an industry that we want to protect. But do we want to have machine tools here? Do we want to have tool and die manufacturing? Do we want to have precision machine tools? Do we want to have a steel industry in the United States? Do we want to be able to manufacture anything from consumer? Do we want to have a consumer electronics industry? You know, we can't build right now a missile without parts from China, a country who has a man in the military who has threatened us with their missiles. So anyhow, Obama points out, you know, there's this competition going on. And then he says, at that point, parents start saying, I'm quoting Barack Obama, parents start saying, why aren't we doing everything we can to prepare our young people, making them adept at math and science so they can get the jobs of the future and be the innovators of the future? Why wouldn't we invest in early childhood education to bring every child up to par? Why wouldn't we start paying our teachers more and help develop training for them to recruit the best and brightest for the classroom? Why on earth would we start increasing the cost of student loans at the precise time that we know that our young people are going to be needing a college education more than ever? Well, yeah, he's right. And good on him for saying it. In my opinion, education all the way through PhD should be free in the United States, as it is in most fully industrialized countries. This is a country investing in its future intellectual infrastructure, its people. And that investment will be returned massively. But what he doesn't say is let's protect our industries. Instead, he's buying into what David Sirota calls the great education myth. This lie that is being told by politicians, by Tom Friedman, by the World is Flat group. That, well, you know, the only reason we can't compete is because we're just not educating well enough. I'm sorry. As David Sirota points out, you could have everybody in the United States have a PhD, and what you'd have is a bunch of unemployed PhDs. We need to fundamentally change the way we interact with the rest of the world on trade. and we need to get our financial house in order. Bernanke and Paulson heading over to China. I'm going to tell you that about that after the break, and then we'll take your call. 16 minutes past the hour.
Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Just consider for a moment this. John Williams, who's an econometrician, he writes the Shadow Government Statistics blog, points out that December 14th and 15th in Beijing, there's going to be a very interesting meeting. Basically, it's the cabinet. I mean, it's the people who sit around George W. They're going to be sitting in China. Now, you know, the Federal Reserve is not part of the cabinet, but here it is. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, and five cabinet-level officials, Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez, Labor Secretary Elaine Chao, Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt, Energy Secretary Sam Bodman, and U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab. Why are all these people going to China? They're going to, you know, scrape and bow. Why? Well, Williams, you know, the government stopped publishing M3, the rate at which they're inflating the currency in March. Williams believes that he's figured out a way to reconstruct that number, and he says that basically the Fed is inflating, or the Treasury Department, arguably the both, I'd say it's basically the Fed, is inflating our currency at the rate of 9.6% a year. And our economy is not growing anywhere near that fast, which means that we have inflation coming and the dollar is going to be worth less. And the Chinese know this. And if they stop buying dollars or they start dumping dollars, we are going to be in big trouble. And so what he's suggesting is that, you know, you're going to, next week, we're going to have the Treasury Secretary, the Fed Chairman, and five members of the President's Cabinet heading over to China to beg China not to throw us into another Great Depression. Meanwhile, the New York Post reporting America's corporate chiefs are unloading their own stocks at one of the boldest paces in 20 years. This is an article by Paul Tharp. And in the cases of the very rich, such as Microsoft's Bill Gates and Google's top brass, the executives are selling a whopping $63 for each dollar of stock they buy, says a report by Bloomberg. In November alone, leaders of public companies dumped $8.4 billion worth of stock they owned as insiders. Analysts say the take the money and run flight from their own companies signals a growing lack of confidence in the economy's future course. And then from today's Wall Street Journal, dollars tumble may hurt players in the carry trade. You ever heard of the carry trade? The carry trade is where you borrow money in Japan, where the interest rate is like less than 1%. So you borrow $1 million in Japan. You take that $1 million and you buy CDs in New Zealand. In other words, you put it in a savings account in New Zealand that pays 7% interest. At the end of the year, you got $70,000, whatever 7% of $1 million is. And you take that money and you pay back $1 million in Japan at the 1% interest rate, and you keep the 5%, 6% margin. It's called the carry trade. And there's people who make a living doing this. I mean, to the tune of trillions of dollars a year. Well, Joanna Slater, writing in the Wall Street Journal, she says the recent weakness in the U.S. dollar is sending tremors through a popular practice in foreign exchange trading known as the carry trade. The trade works best when currencies remain relatively stable. Already, the U.S. dollar's tumble against the euro is prompting some observers to predict that currency rates around the world will be more volatile going forward. This is bad news for the carry trade. The stakes are high. The last time these trades unraveled was in the spring, when investors, spooked by the prospect of rising Japanese interest rates, abandoned riskier investments in countries from Iceland to Turkey. You will recall Turkey almost fell. I mean, their economy
almost slid into a depression. Their stock market crashed. Same thing happened in Iceland. She says the recent sell-off in the U.S. dollar will lead to larger fluctuations in other currencies. The reverberations would extend well beyond financial market players. Regulators in South Korea, for example, are investigating the ballooning number of yen-denominated loans granted by local banks. Lured by the low interest rates attached to such loans, individuals have plowed the proceeds into higher-yielding assets like real estate, spurring fears of a bubble. This is what's happening here. This is what Kevin Phillips, the guy who wrote the coming Republican wave or whatever, the book back in the 60s that predicted the rise of the Republican Party, the Republican Kevin Phillips, in his two most recent books about the U.S. economy, which are very spot on, by the way. Kevin Phillips, who's become a big critic of the Republican Party, suggests that we're basically now a nation of arbitrage. We no longer manufacture things. We're no longer, even our service industry is very, very weak. And so most of our money is being made moving money around, borrowing money, selling money, lending money, buying money. And you can't maintain an economy like that. So, you know, global economy, the fall of the mighty dollar. Is the end of an era looming in the foreign exchange market? This is from Spiegel Online, the German newspaper. They're talking about the dollar crashing. I think we've got to be concerned about this. Pay some attention to it and hold our politicians to account. 27 minutes after the hour.
You're a foul one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wasty skunk. Your heart is full of unwashed socks. Your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three words that best describe you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk.
You're a rotter. Yes. Mr. Bush. No, Mr. Grinch, yes. Holiday season's greetings. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. So what do we do? What do we do? We have our government has gone from, which is us, by the way. I mean, this being a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, our government is us. We have gone from being the richest country in the world, the largest creditor in the world, the largest supplier of cash to other countries in the world, the largest owner of other businesses in the world. In 1980, when Ronald Reagan ran for office, 1981 when he took office, from being the wealthiest nation in the world to being today the most indebted nation in the world. We owe $8.7 trillion. You and I. I mean, it's an absolutely massive and mind-boggling debt. Your share of that debt is $28,846.90. If you're the breadwinner of a family of four, you owe $115,387.61. Most of that debt run up by Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, and George W. Bush. The only president who tried to pay any of it down was Bill Clinton. And that was only in the last couple of years of his presidency. But, you know, God bless him for trying. So what do we do? Well, number one, we get our internal financial house in order. Do away with earmarks, hold Congress responsible, say, if you're going to pass a law, you can't combine it with other laws. None of this giant omnibus, hey, let's do $1 trillion with this. One at a time, please. The way it used to be. Number one. Raise taxes up to the point, income taxes, progressive income taxes, up to the point, and particularly corporate taxes, up to the point where government is paying for itself. If corporations are going to be using the infrastructure of this nation, they should be paying for it. It's really simple. They used to pay between a third and a half of the tax bill of the United States, and they use about half of the total infrastructure of the United States, from the court systems to our prison systems to our educational system. Very heavy users of our educational system. We provide an educated workforce. Our police, maintaining our rights of way, our streets, our roads, our skyways, our railways, all so that business can be conducted. Corporations are heavy users. Some estimates, more than 50% of the commons are used by corporations. And yet, what they're paying, what? 6, 7, 8, 9% of the total tax of the total tax load? It used to be between a third and a half. When you combine federal and state, I mean, it varies from state to state. Or Oregon, where I live, for example, has the lowest corporate tax in the United States. It's around 7%, I think, of taxes are paid by corporations, and 93% are paid by individuals. It's just wrong. So stop allowing them to game the system. So number one, let's get our economic house in order after 26 years of being kneecapped by these so-called conservatives. Let's go back to tax rates like we had under John Kennedy or like we had under Dwight Eisenhower, which built a massive and powerful middle class and industrial infrastructure in this country. And secondly, let's go back to trade policies like we had under John Kennedy and Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, you can pick Republican presidents as well as Democratic presidents. They all understood it was rational and reasonable. It's only been since the insanity of Reagan started to infect this country with all these crank right-wing ideas. It's not rocket science. It's just that no politician, I mean, even Barack Obama, as I pointed out, is willing to say it. And they're not willing to say it because they're not hearing it from people like you and me. And we need to start speaking out and speaking to them. Al in Winchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Al, welcome to the program.
All right. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Al?
All right. I have a question for you. And so, all right. If a corporation has the same constitutional rights as an individual, and its main priority is to turn a profit and provide a service, theoretically and stuff, could a corporation run for office?
Well, as a matter of fact, here in Oregon, there is a group of folks, they started this End Corporate Personhood campaign out of the Unitarian Church in Portland 3 or 4 years ago when I came to town to give a talk on my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And this year, in the gubernatorial campaign, they tried to run a corporation named Rich Corporate Son Incorporated for governor. And we actually had a debate where I debated the representatives of the corporation while this stuffed dummy sat in the chair, the Rich Corporate Son, Inc. And so I debated a corporation. And I also moderated the gubernatorial debates in the primaries between the actual sitting governor of the state and his two Democratic challengers. It was a weird experience. They were not actually legally allowed to put the corporation on the ballot, but they tried. They got a lot of publicity, and it was a good shot. So
but wouldn't it make a great statement if the working class formed a corporation to get representation?
That's what they did here in Portland, and I would encourage other communities to do the same. It was a really great illustration for people who are going, what, corporate personhood, what? And you say, no, corporations are claiming that they have First Amendment rights of free speech, the right to lie. If I can say to my wife, hey, you look great in that dress, and I don't believe it, corporations should be able to say, hey, eat this stuff, it won't make you sick. They're claiming Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. We don't have to tell you that asbestos will kill you. Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Yeah, we don't have to tell you whether or not we knew that tobacco would kill you. 14th Amendment rights against discrimination. Oh, you can't keep a Walmart out of your community. After all, that would be the same thing as keeping a black person away from a lunch counter that says whites only. They're claiming these rights, in my opinion, illegally. And Al, you're spot on right. We need to highlight it more, and we need to do it theatrically. I think it's a great suggestion, a great idea. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Richard in Fremont, California. Hey, Richard.
Yes, Tom. I had a comment to make about, the H-1B visas and so on, which is kind of the opposite of outsourcing. We don't have jobs to go around here, but we're insourcing labor, which...
we're importing labor, yeah. Insourcing is the word that they use to describe a foreign corporation setting up shop here and hiring local folks. So, but yeah, we're importing labor.
That's true. And then that just greases the slicks to outsource it.
Yeah, well, what it does is it drives down the cost of labor. I mean, in 1814, David Ricardo wrote a paper that everybody in America should be required to read in high school economics called On Labor. And he said in that paper that if you go back over the 7,000-year history of laissez-faire economics in what we call civilization, that whenever you have an absolutely unregulated economy, When the supply of labor equals roughly the demand for labor, the cost of labor will drop to what he referred to, what David Ricardo referred to as a subsistence level. That is enough to keep people from starving and no more. And that's what we've seen. That's, you know, that was what Victorian England, you know, Dickens wrote about this. A Christmas Carol. Here we are at the season, right? People are going to read A Christmas Carol. You end up with a very small, very wealthy ruling class, the kings and the dukes and whatnot, and the feudal lords, a very small mercantile middle class. And Scrooge and Marley was actually the middle class of Victorian England. You know, he ran a small two-person business. He was a small businessman. And then you have a very, very large class of the working poor. Bob Cratchit and you know, the working poor have no health care. Tiny Tim didn't have medical care, and they have to depend upon charity for anything. And that's what's normal. In fact, Dickens' father was thrown into a debtor's prison when Dickens was a kid. It was an experience he carried his entire life, which is why he always wrote about, you know, the poor in England, you know, in a variety of his stories. So David Ricardo pointed this out, and so the challenge is always to reduce the supply of labor relative to the demand, thus driving up the price of it. You could argue that the Black Death, the Black Plague in Europe in the 1400s, what was it, 1435 or 53 or whatever it was, it led directly to the Renaissance, because it reduced the supply of labor. A third of Europe died off, in some cases two-thirds, and thus the demand for labor increased, which produced, bingo, a middle class. Then the middle class went away. You went back into the middle ages. And then, you know, all this, the discovery of gold in the Americas and free land, you know, free, you could steal it from the Native Americans, produced a second middle class. And that middle class led to the Enlightenment. And in both cases, it was a result of the demand for labor being driven up and that producing a middle class. And, you know, corporations understand this, conservatives understand this, and they're all about increasing the supply of labor to drive down the price of it so that they can increase their profit.
Yeah, that's right. You made a point of that, I think, in your book, Screwed.
Yeah, yeah, there's a whole chapter on it.
Periods in history when you really had a middle class.
Yeah, middle class is not a normal thing. Franklin Roosevelt created a middle class out of nothing by saying, we're not going to have laissez-faire economics in the United States. We're going to have a regulated economy.
And I also wanted to note, you know, the Congress in the closing moments failed to increase the quotas for those visas. And that was largely responsible there for Senator Sessions of Alabama put the hold on those in the judiciary.
Well, they're starting to feel it.
Otherwise, the Democrats and the Republicans in the judiciary would have pushed it.
Yeah, they're really starting to feel the heat. I mean, whether it's the Republican Lou Dobbs, who's taking a very populist position, and good on him for it. I mean, he's, you know, one of the few decent Republicans still around, I suppose, and on some issues. You know, and certainly on trade and on this immigration issue by and large, or whether it's progressives, you know, who have since the mid 1800s fought to reduce the supply of labor and thus drive up the price of it with things like maximum hour laws, you know, 40-hour week or 50-hour week, the weekends, you know, you get weekends off, doing away with child labor, promoting unionization. All of these things create a middle class. 45 minutes past the hour.
So just because he wasn't really elected, just because that ballot count wasn't fair, just because him and all his friends are millionaires, don't mean he don't care.
No, don't you know he's a compassionate conservative? Indeed. Welcome back. News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. Mary in the Bay Area in California on the line, listening on the Quake. Hey, Mary.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Tom. Oh, my. You give your listeners and callers so much to respond to that. Well, I'm sitting here online with one point that come up with others and others, but I'll keep it down.
Sorry, Mary.
But I did wish, here's on my wish list, that you would write a school curriculum. I don't know if you've ever been approached to do that in economics and in civics, something like that.
I have. There is a 130-page comic book out called We the People, A Call to Take Back America. And it is a summary of American history and economics that I wrote. And it's great. And there are about a dozen places in it where it takes kind of pot shots at Bush. And the publisher right now is reinventing it as a result of demand from high school teachers all over the country as a three-book set. In other words, he's breaking it down into thirds and taking out all of the references to George Bush. So it's just all the history stuff. And that should be available, I don't know, in the next few months. But,
oh, this is exciting.
Yeah, if you go to tomhartmann.com and there's a link on there to We the People, the book or something like that. There's a little square ad about halfway down my homepage, and you just click on that ad and it'll take you to the homepage for the book, and that lets you contact the publisher.
But, okay.
And the book is available in any bookstore right now.
And the other thing came up in my mind was that, well, so that we're not accused, liberals aren't accused of having no humor. A couple of humorous thoughts came when I was listening about the debt. And it's like when a foreign nation buys our debt, it's as if we get the idea, well, we got that out. We got rid of that now. We exported that. We sold that.
Yes. We're exporting our debt.
And the other, yeah. I guess, more horrible, amusing thought is when we, if we would ever find a way to outsource our well, you know, the bills that come up in for our elected officials, they're so heavy and hundreds.
Oh, the legislation? You mean the legislation?
Yeah, the legislation.
Yeah, why don't we just hire a president in India?
Yeah, somebody who's familiar with our constitution, and they can read through these heavy bills,
yeah.
and they can narrow summarize it and pass it back to us.
There you go. Yeah, let's outsource the White House. Good
right.
plan, Mary.
And then the last point, the point that your screener didn't let me chicken out on, an earlier discussion you had about how astonishing and bewildered and appalled some are with how foreign countries could have so much sway over our foreign policy.
Yeah.
I thought that she didn't let me chicken out on this because I'm less brave than President Carter, but it seems evident that Israel has more sway over the administration in assessing Iraq, Iran, and Syria than our own domestic Iraq study group.
It may be. I'm suspecting, frankly, right now that Saudi Arabia is the tail that's wagging the dog. There are a lot of interests in the Middle
East.
Yeah,
there's a lot of tails, too.
yeah, there are. And it's just a mess we never should have stepped into in the first
yeah.
place. Mary,
well,
thank you for the call. Yep, good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Ken in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hi. Regarding your previous discussion with how tough the Democrats should or shouldn't be and what they should respond to,
yeah.
it seems to me we've been losing for the last 40 years for the most part because we keep playing by the Marcus of Queensbury rules while they keep gutter fighting, going back to the Donald Zuccaretti and the Rat Pack and the Muskie and all. And I just think that until we get to the point where we can out-rove Karl Rove, and I hate to say that, we can expose people like Richard Mellon Scaife, make the connection between
yeah.
the money that the oil companies are raking in and the hardships of...
Ken, you know, what you're describing is this essential quandary. I wrote about it, there's a chapter about it in a book I wrote called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I went out and I interviewed in Davis, California, Professor Jack Forbes. He's a Native American. He's a professor of Native American studies there. And he wrote a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals, which is brilliant. And in it, he used this word, wetiko, which is a Native American word that I forget which tribe or community that describes basically the eating of the life force of another. It's a cannibalism that isn't literally cannibalism. And he said that many of the Native Americans, when they were confronted by Europeans who were willing to kill them to steal their land, were faced with basically three possibilities and only three possibilities. They could run away, which many did. The Shoshone, for example, there was a lot of territory they could run and hide, number one. Number two, they could die. In other words, they could just stand their ground and be killed. And many were, probably the majority were. Or they could fight back. But the problem with fighting back is that they would have to become their enemy. And as soon as they had done that, they had already lost. And I mean, consider that for a moment. Do we really want to become Republicans?
That's just temporary.
Well, see, that's a nice rationalization, but I don't buy it.
Well,
I think when you become a psychopath, you're a psychopath.
Well, Al Gore allowed Tom DeLay's thugs to disrupt the vote count in Florida.
Sure, and he should have pointed it out, and he should have fought back. But, you know, putting LSD in Ed Muskie's coffee and breaking in on the Democratic National Convention, the stuff that Nixon did, you know, negotiating with the Ayatollahs in Iran to hold the hostages like Reagan and Bush did. I mean, these kind of dirty tricks, I would hope and pray that the Democratic Party will never go down that road. They just need to be better at pointing out what's really going on and telling the truth about it, and not being afraid to speak up and speak out. Tomorrow I'll be challenging the first Republican declared presidential candidate, John Cox, on his statement that only competition can drive down drug prices. Yeah, right. That and the best of the rest of the news, plus your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, the radio support group of By and For We the People. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.